too much mass to balance. Yeah, exactly. I think it could be good. I mean, it's turning, it's almost a little bit bad, but I think it could be good. Okay, yeah, I can send you a form of the next time. That's fine. Is there anything else I should, I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, and I mean, it just kind of emphasized the modularity of the subject. I think it'll be good, but well, I guess we'll see. Hi. No, just for the visiting students. Okay, so let's get started. So last time we talked about logistic regression, which was a particular linear classification method. So it was a way of taking ideas that we had seen from linear regression and applying them to the classification problem. So we got about halfway through that last time. But before we finish with logistic regression, I wanted to take a bit of a detour and talk about methods for doing numerical optimization. Because as we'll see, this is a an interesting, complex mathematical area that is vital for doing not only logistic regression, but also many of the classification techniques that we'll see later on in the course. So before I talk about this, I have one short announcement, and that is that the math surgeries are this week. And if you're American, that sounds much more gruesome, apparently, than it does if you're British. But these are basically just extra tutorial sessions that are optional. You can go to if you want, if you have questions about, if you're having some trouble with the mathematical material. So actually, this lecture will be fairly mathematical. So hopefully, we will. You might generate some questions. Basically, it's just a Q&A session. So if there are things that you don't understand, things from the slides that you're not sure about, you can go at one of those times and just bring your questions to the tutor. There was a session on Monday as well. That's today. There was a session earlier today. And I know there was some issue with like a weird sign being on the door of the room saying, don't go in or something like that. But that's been sorted out. So if there is a scary sign on the door, you can just ignore it. It will be in Appleton Tower 412. Okay, so let me talk about this idea of kind of numerical optimization. So what we've seen is that a lot of the methods that we've seen so far, not all of them, but a lot of them, have taken this learning problem and converted it into a continuous optimization problem. So by continuous optimization, I mean we want to find like the minimum of some function has a function of a continuous set of parameters. So we've seen examples of this, like linear regression is an example of this. We're about to see logistic regression either today or tomorrow, we'll see, is an example of this. And later this week, we'll see both neural networks and SVMs, and both of them do this. And a key idea for doing this is maximum likelihood. So we have some model that has some set of parameters W, and so each set of parameters W leads to a different distribution of the data, Y and X. And I want to find the set of parameters W that makes the data most likely. So that's this thing up here is the log likelihood for a generative model, where the inputs are y1, y2, the inputs are x1, x2, up to xn, and the outputs are like the class labels or the target values for the regression are y1, y2, yn. So a lot of times we have we have IID data. So in that case, we have this big probability up at the top kind of degenerates into the smaller probability on the second line, where instead of trying to predict all the data at once, all we have to predict is the log product over all the data points, which I'm numbering I from 1 to n, of yi xi given w. So this is the kind of thing that you maximize to get the naive Bayes classifier, for instance. And then to get to the third line, just using the fact that the log of a product equals the sum of the logs. So this is one of those things that's always true for logarithms. And if you don't understand why this works, then you need to go to the math surgeries this week. And so then you get to this thing at the bottom. So the thing at the bottom is the log likelihood for a generative model with IID data. So an example that we've seen with that is naive Bayes is one example of this, where we could get the best values for W in closed form. And also linear regression is another example of this. So the so in all of these cases, you can visualize this situation as follows. You have this error function, so this thing e, and you can think of e as just being the negative of the log likelihood. So you want to minimize the errors that you get on the training data as a function of w. So if you think of a imagine that your data set is fixed. So all the graphs I'm going to show in this lecture are things where the axes are going to be w. They're going to be the parameters of the model. So like the weights of a linear regression model, and the y-axis is going to be the error that I make on the training data. So like the squared error or the log likelihood, or the log likelihood more generally, has a function of w. So what I'm going to say, so in one dimension, I'll have some curve that looks like this. So where for the best value of w, I'll have a pretty low error, and then it'll kind of go up as I move away. Or you could also have, this would be if I have one parameter. I would have some error surface that looks like this. But typically, I have more than one parameter. I might have 10 parameters or 100 parameters. So I have some error surface that lives in multiple dimensions. So I might have one axis would be weight wi, another axis would be weight wj. So these might be in linear regression. These would be weights for two different features. And then I have some function that says, so this function now takes a vector as input. It's e of boldface w. And it says, well, what's the error given those two parameter values? And so what learning is essentially doing is that I have some current parameter value, and I want to descend the error surface. I want to find some point. I want to find a new value of the parameters that's lower than the one that I have so far. And ideally, I'd like to find the minimum value of the error over all of the parameter settings. And the nice thing is if the data are IID, then this error function just breaks up into a sum, just like it did on the previous slide. So the likelihood breaks up into a sum over training instances. And since the error is just the negative of the likelihood, this e is just the negative of the likelihood, then it does as well. So that's graphically what we're going to try to do when we cast a learning problem as an optimization problem. So in some examples, so for example, in linear regression and in naive Bayes, we cast learning as optimization. And then we were able to get the solution in closed form. All we had to do was algebra and calculus. More generally, we'll see that things aren't so nice. We actually have to call some complicated numerical procedure, some complicated function, in order to find the minimization. And so this is the type of problem that numerical optimization problems try to solve. So they take, in general, I have some function e, which is a function of some vector w, and I want to find the minimum of that with respect to w. So you can write that using that notation up at the top. And the problem may actually be worse than that. I may actually have constraints on the possible w that are allowable. So I may have some set of functions, c0, c1, and so on. And I may want to say that I'm only interested in values of w for which each of those functions c are, say, positive. Now, why might you want to do that? One example would be, say, I'm doing naive Bayes with Gaussian outputs. So then if I'm optimizing with a variance, the variance parameters of those Gaussians have to be positive. So I'm only interested in solutions where the variance components of w are positive. Another kind of example was something we saw in the second lecture. So there we talked about maximum likelihood for multinomial distributions. So you said, well, if I rolled a die, an unfair die, some number of times, and I told you the counts at which each side came up, then give me the maximum likelihood parameters for the weights on the die. So that was a case in which I was maximizing over probability distributions, and so I had the constraint that the sum over all w had to sum to 1. So I could represent it, so that would be another kind of constraint that I could have. And finally, we'll see later on some of the more complex learning techniques. SVMs actually add a different kind of constraint, which is different than either of those. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. But so for now, I'm going to ignore the issue of constraints because they make optimization much more difficult. But you should know that in some learning methods, we do have to deal with those. But right now, I'm just going to talk about how we minimize w without constraints. OK, so the first thing to see right away is that if I don't make any assumptions about E, then the minimization problem is basically impossible. So why is that? I could have some really bumpy function like this, where I have some value of W. If I perturb W just slightly, then the value of the error changes dramatically. And if that happens, then there's no way to know if I'm at some point W and I measure the error. There's really no way to know, just from where I am, how to get to a better point. Right? So if I'm in some situation where the error function looks like this, the best thing that I can do is just brute force search. It's just look at all possible values of w and see what the best error is. So that would be really bad if that was the only way that we could do learning. So fortunately, there is another there's another fact that we can exploit about E, which is, I mean, we've chosen the error function E in many cases for mathematical convenience. So remember when we talked about the squared error, we chose that because we knew how to take derivatives. So a lot of these functions E are actually nice functions. They don't look like this. They're actually continuous functions. Or better yet, they're often smooth functions, meaning that they have derivatives. So if that's the case, then measuring the value of E, then at some W, I can measure E of W, and maybe I can also measure the gradient of E. And so what that gives me is that doesn't just give me information about E at the point W, but it gives information about E about at lots of nearby values of W. So that way I can get some idea about, given that I'm at some W, what direction could I go to get to a better value? So the key thing that basically all numerical optimization algorithms exploit is this idea of smoothness. So the other, now what smoothness means, so there's continuity and there's smoothness. What smoothness means is that you have a function for which derivatives exist at all orders. So I can take first derivatives, second derivatives, third derivatives, and so on. So a smooth function is necessarily continuous. So why do we care about derivatives? Well, the big thing we want to know when we're doing optimization is you have to realize numerical optimizations are kind of myopic, right? It's very easy. If I just draw a curved function on the board, you can just look at it, right? Your visual system is very, very good. You just look at it and say, okay, that's the minimum. But the algorithm doesn't get to do that. All the algorithm gets to see is I'm at some point, it has some value. And maybe I've been at past points and has past values. So what I want to know is just given this myopic view of where I am, I mean, if I were to change one of the weights a little bit, would the error get better or worse? So if I were to wiggle W in one direction, would it get better? If I were to wiggle W in another direction, would it get better? So this is where calculus comes into play. I mean, what calculus can tell you is, given if I make an infinitesimal change to the weights in one direction WK, how would the error change? And that's just a partial derivative. So everything we're going to do is going to be about using some differentiable cost function, and then using the derivatives to help us tell us which way to go in order to find better values of the cost function. Now, if you don't remember from calculus, you should also go to the math surgeries if you don't remember this, but the vector of all the partial derivatives is called the gradient. And the gradient points in the gradient basically gives you the steepest direction in error space. So it tells you I want to descend the gradient in order to minimize a function. And actually, it's easy to get it reversed and try to remember, well, does the gradient go to higher values of error or lower values of error? And if you ever get confused by that, do it in one dimension. So the gradient actually points, so if you say, you can't really see this. So if I have y equals x squared, the gradient for that is dy dx equals 2x, and you can see that points uphill. So the gradient points in the direction of steepest increase in the function. That's what I use as a mnemonic, whatever works for you. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to try to follow the gradient. So now if we want to use that idea to implement an algorithm, then that leaves us with three questions, which are on the slides. I'll give you a second to read them. The first one is we have to actually compute the gradient. Now, the way you do that is going to depend on the particulars, specific things of the model, right? That's going to be different for linear regression than for logistic regression than for SVMs. So I'm not going to talk about the first question in this lecture. That's going to be in each of the individual lectures for each learning method. But the second question is, once I give you the gradient, how am I going to use that to come up with an algorithm that minimizes the error? So that's what most of this lecture is going to be about. And then the question is, well, once I finish the algorithm, you know, where did I end up? Did I really end up at a minimum, or did I end up at some random location? Okay, so this is now let's look at how optimization algorithms work. So this is a cartoon that basically, like, optimization algorithms can get really, really complicated. There's a lot of linear algebra involved that we're not going to expect you to know in this course. But at a cartoon level, all optimization algorithms look the same. And the way it works is that it's iterative. So at every iteration of the algorithm, I have some current point, so like W2. And usually I measure the value of the objective function at that point. And typically I'll also measure the gradient at that point. So after two iterations of the algorithm, I'll know where I am now, W2. And I'll also know where I am at the previous points. So these iterative algorithms generate a sequence of points, one for each iteration of the outer loop. And so the basic algorithm is,
I'll initialize w at some value. Sometimes it matters where you initialize it, and sometimes it not. Depends on the error function. And for each iteration, it's going to propose one new value for w. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to, for each iteration, until I decide to stop, so until it looks like that I'm near a minimum, what I'm going to do is I'm going to calculate the current gradient. And then given that gradient, I'm going to decide some direction in weight space. And I say I'm going to try to go down that direction in order to minimize the error. And so I'm going to decide this in some way based on the current w, the current value of the objective function, the current gradient, and maybe past values as well in some of the more clever optimization methods. Once I've decided on that direction d, I'm going to take a small step in the direction d. So I'm going to take, so this thing eta is just a scalar. It's a real number. It's greater than 0. It's going to be something small, so like 0.1 or 0.01, something like that. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to update w by changing it to move a small value in the direction d. So that'll give me a new value of w. And now I'll go and I'll iterate the loop, and I'll compute a new gradient. So what all optimization algorithms are about, in some sense, is how do I choose this value? Well, it's both about how do I choose d. And then some of the really complicated algorithms are also about how I choose eta. Some of them will many of them will choose both. OK, so now, let's see. OK, so now I'm going to talk about a particular simple choice for the direction d, which you might be able to guess given what I've talked about so far. And that is the gradient. So locally, the gradient gives me the steepest. The gradient points upward. So locally, I can get the steepest descent direction from the gradient. And so why is that? Why is that a good choice? The reason is calculus. So the reason is if you have some hazy memory of Taylor's theorem, it's a very important theorem from calculus, and it underlies all of these optimization methods. And I'm not going to go through the formal statement of it, but all it says is that every continuous point looks like a polynomial if I squint at it. So what that says, if you look at this professionally done drawing, it's up on the slide, if I have some kind of weird, wild function, as long as it's continuous, if I zoom in to any one point in the function, so say I zoom in to some point w0 on the right-hand side, if I look close enough at the function around w0, then I can approximate this complicated function, at least in this local area, I can approximate it by a line. So this thing that I've written up here is just the equation for a line. It's the equation for a line that starts at w0 and then has the slope of the line is given by the gradient. So w is just the value of the function. So what I can do is, if I want to minimize a function, I can approximate it by a line and then take a small step to try to make that linear function smaller and hope that by doing so, I'll also make the real function smaller. And that's what gradient descent is. So what gradient descent does is say, well, the way I'm going to choose the direction based on this argument from Taylor's theorem is to pick the gradient. So what I'm going to do is I'll just take the cartoon algorithm that I had from two slides ago, and I'll just substitute in that choice of the direction. So all I do at every iteration is I compute this gradient. I'll have some value eta, and I'll update w to be a small step in the opposite direction of the gradient. So eta is this parameter that's we call the step size. Sometimes it's called the learning rate, but I think that's a pretty stupid name. So I'm going to call it the step size. And it's very important to the performance of this method what you choose the step size. So if I choose the step size to be very, very small, then what's going to happen is if I choose it to be 0.00001, then the algorithm's just never going to go anywhere, right? But if I choose it to be too large, then that's bad too. Because what's going to happen is this linear approximation that I made on the previous slide, it obviously doesn't hold anywhere. Right? If I try to use the linear approximation from w0 and use it to approximate the function over here, it's going to be really stupid. So if I make eta too small, then I'm trusting the linear approximation too much. And so I'm going to be unstable. I'm going to zoom around all over the place. So you really need, there's some trade-off. You really need some kind of intermediate value of eta. And the value of eta you want to use, it depends on the problem. There's no problem-independent way of setting eta. You have to know something about E. So that's why I don't like to use the term learning rate for this, although you will see this in many textbooks, because why wouldn't you set the learning rate to maximum, right? But no, it's more like I don't want to take a step that's too big. So that's gradient descent. So you might say, what's some way to set eta? So what I have up here is kind of this heuristic for adaptively choosing a way to set eta. So it's something that you could use if you're desperate. In reality, you should probably never use this algorithm if you have another choice, for the sole reason that you shouldn't be implementing your own optimization algorithms. Right? Whatever possible, like all of MATLAB and so on, there are libraries for doing optimization that implement all of these for you. But to give you some idea how this works and to be useful in a pinch, this is a reasonable heuristic for choosing the step size. So all this does is this is exactly the algorithm on the previous slide for gradient descent. So what I do is the first two lines are just saying, well, I have to pick some initial value for edit, some initial value of the weight vector to start with. And then on the second line, I say, well, I'll compute the value in the gradient at that value that I chose for the initialization. Now, before that word while, I should have put a hard return to put it on its own line. So now I have this while loop. And then what I'm doing for this loop is I'm taking one gradient step according to the current value of eta. That gives me this thing W1. That's this new value that I propose. And I'm going to compute the error in the gradient for that thing. Usually you can get both of them. Usually there's one function you can call to get both of them at the same time. So you just compute both of those and then say, well, did I get better or not? So did I actually, if the step was, if eta is small enough, then I'm guaranteed to decrease the error, but I might decrease it by a very small amount. If eta is too big, I might overstep and I might actually increase the error of the function of the parameters, even though I meant to decrease it. So what I do is I look at the new error. And I say, is it worse than the old error? If it is, then I say, I backtrack, I ignore that step, and I make eta smaller. So just divide eta by 2. Otherwise, I had a good step. I actually did decrease the value of the function. So let me make eta a little bit bigger. I'll try to follow the gradient a little bit faster, and then I'll accept W1 and G1 as being the new values of the, as being my new parameters. And that's it. That's the whole algorithm. So it's just gradient descent, where I'm doing this little bit of adaptivity, where that, like, if I see that I'm still getting better, I'll speed up how fast I follow the gradient. And if I'm not getting better, I'll slow down how fast I follow the gradient. It's very, very simple heuristic. And this will find a local minimum of E. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. But it does at least get to something, it does get to the bottom of some bowl of the error. OK, so that's gradient descent. So now there's another kind of, what I showed is this is a batch algorithm for doing gradient descent. So what do I mean by batch? So remember, I said I had this one line in the function that says calculate the gradient. So what does it mean to calculate the gradient? It means, so if the data are IID, it means I looped through every single training instance. I said, okay, for each training instance, I said, okay, what's your little gradient? You know, what's the gradient of your error? What's the gradient of your error? And so on. I went like that through every training instance. And then I added them up to get the total error. And the reason that I was allowed to do that is because I assumed that the training data was IID. So there are a lot of good things about that kind of batch. So a batch method means that you scan all of the training data before making any changes to the parameters. That's the definition of a batch method. Now, there are lots of good things about batch methods. It turns out that some of the more sophisticated optimization algorithms than gradient descent, they work really well in batch methods. And batch methods are easy to analyze theoretically. But there are some things that aren't so good about batch methods. So one thing is, if I expect that my data has a lot of similarity in it, so maybe if I went outside Appleton Tower and I took a whole set of images, I might expect that, and I took 1,000 images or something, I took 1,000 pictures of Appleton Tower, which seems kind of grim. So you'd imagine a lot of those pictures are very similar to each other. So if I took one of those 1,000 pictures versus another, and I took one of those, delta E's, if I took one of those partial derivatives just over those images, then you would think, well, probably the gradients for all those images point in similar directions. So if that's the case, maybe I could have just taken one of those images, computed the gradient for that image, and used that as an approximation to the gradient if I summed over all images. And so that's what's called an online method. So basically, what an online method means is that I adapt weights once for each pattern. So after I've computed the gradient for just one of the training instances, or maybe a few, maybe two or three, that I take that gradient and I use that as a descent direction within gradient descent. So that's called an online method. And that's actually very commonly used, or sometimes it's called a stochastic gradient descent. And that's very commonly used within neural networks, which we'll talk about probably a week from today.
So the nice thing about online methods is if you have this really large data set, then you can save a lot of time because you don't have to go through the whole data set to tune the parameters. Or if you have this stream of data, so maybe you're constantly getting data, like if you're a website, maybe you're getting like a movie ratings from Netflix, so you're constantly getting thousands of ratings a day. Then you just want to process data as it comes in and do a small amount of work for each data item. So that's something that could be good about online methods. So that's something else to keep in mind when you're trying to decide which optimization algorithm to use for a problem. You could do batch gradient descent, or you could do online gradient descent. Okay, so the nice thing about gradient descent is that it's this very simple algorithm, and it's very broadly applicable to a wide variety of problems. But there are a couple things that really aren't so good about gradient descent. So now I'm going to talk about two or three characteristics of the objective function that can really screw up gradient descent. So one of them is this issue of shallow valleys. So suppose I have an error function that looks like that thing up there at the top. Then what's going to happen is I have some valley that has really steep sides. But once I get to the bottom of the valley, it's very, very shallow down to the eventual minimum. So what happens is once I get to the bottom, the gradient descent is going to be really, really good at finding the bottom of the valley. But then once I get there, the gradient is really small. The norm of the gradient is very, very small. So if I'm taking small steps in the direction of the gradient, it's going to take me a very long time to get eventually to the bottom of that valley. So there are hacks that you can use to deal with this. So this is like one way of augmenting standard gradient descent, is this idea of momentum. So this is another one of those, these guys who did neural networks, a lot of these guys used online gradient descent. And they became very, very good at tuning online gradient descent to work for neural networks. And they came up with this. There are 20-page papers, actually, they might be longer than that, about all the tricks that you need to do in order to get gradient descent to work on neural networks. So this is one of those tricks. And that's called momentum. And the idea is I remember the previous gradients. So instead of taking the direction to be the gradient at the current point, you take the direction to be some weighted sum of the gradient at all the previous points. So this would be like at some current value of WWT, this is the direction DT that you would take in that cartoon optimization algorithm. So what you do is you say, I'm going to take some weighted combination of the last direction I went in, which is this DT minus 1, and the gradient at the current point, which is this delta E. And that's the new direction you're going to take. And so this beta parameter is a parameter that you have to set. It's usually something that's very high, like 0.95 or something like that. And so the good thing about that is if I get to this narrow valley, then once I make a couple small steps in the direction of the gradient, then I'm going to accumulate these past gradients and start to gain momentum and roll down this valley very quickly. The other thing that people liked about this was the way that it dealt with local minimum. But I haven't told you about that yet, so I'll save that for a couple slides later. Now, so those are the nice things about it. The irritating thing about this is I really hate setting parameters like eta. I mean, that's just like you have to run the same method again for eta 0.1, eta 0.01, and so on. It's a real pain in the butt. So now you have two parameters to set instead of one parameter. So in some sense, you've made things quadratically harder if you're doing a grid search. So I guess if you get good at this, you might have favored values of eta and beta. But this is like anytime you have a method that has more parameters than two, it's a little bit harder to use. So that's one of the problems of using momentum. Okay, but there's another way. So shallow valleys are one way in which you can trick gradient descent. Another way that you can trick gradient descent is if your error surface has high curvature. So what I mean by that is rather than if you imagine an independent Gaussian and you look at the level sets of that Gaussian, they're just going to look like circles. So there's going to be they're going to look like these very nice. If I move in one direction, I'll have basically the same derivative in that direction as I would if I picked any other direction. So it looks kind of very nice. There's not much dependency between the variables that I'm trying to optimize. That's not typically what happens.
Typically, I have a surface that's highly curved, like this one that's on the slide. So what that means is it's just to remind you, these things here are level sets of the error function. So think of it like you're reading a map, like elevations on a map. So what happens is if the objective function has high curvature, what that means is the gradient doesn't point towards the optimum. Even though it's locally, the gradient points you in the best direction for going downhill, or the negative of the gradient points you in the best direction for going downhill. It might not globally, it might not point towards the nearest local minimum. So in this function here, it's always the case, so anytime you draw a function like this, it's always the case that the gradient is orthogonal to the level sets. So what that means is, so that dashed line is a set of points that all have the same value of the objective function. So if I want to get as far away from that set as possible, then I should go downhill at a right angle to that. And so that's always the way the gradient's going to point. It's going to point at a right angle to the level sets. So if I do that, so then once I've shown the level sets, you could tell me what the gradient is at any point just by drawing a line like that, gradient DE right there. And as you can see, in a curved surface, this is going to point nowhere towards, it's going to point nowhere towards the optimum. It's not even going to point necessarily in a very good direction. So the for example, if I tried to run gradient descent in a situation that looked like that thing at the top, it would look something like this. I don't know if you're going to be able to see this at all. So this is the error function here, and say I'm going to start at some point here, and say I pick and the gradient at this point, it's going to have to point in this direction, because that's not me. I don't have any cows on my screen. Anyway, so the gradient's going to point in this direction here. Now suppose I'm really good at picking the step size. Suppose I happen to pick the step size that minimizes the function along this line here. I just really get lucky with my choice of eta. Well, then I'm going to go to a point like this. So if this is W0, then this thing is going to be W1. And so now I'm going to get at some point that's inside like this. So now I'm going to move in some, I'll get actually like right here. This wasn't a very good example. So now what'll happen is I'll be at some point inside like here, and maybe my gradient points in this direction. So I'll move some point here. And I'll just keep, and what happens is I just keep kind of moving in stair step right angles, right? Because I'm never pointing, it can typically happen that I never actually point directly towards the minimum, but I'm always pointing kind of locally, I'm always moving locally downhill like this. So I'll get something where I'm moving like this. And it can take me a very large number of steps to get to the eventual minimum. That's good. So curve, wow, that's nice. Oh, it's decided not to, there we go. Okay, good. Oh, yeah, that one's fine. Okay, good. So if in a curved surface like this, it can take a long time for gradient descent to reach the eventual minimum. And the way you measure this kind of curvature is using the Hessian matrix, which is just the matrix of second derivatives. So a case in which the Hessian matrix is very far from an identity matrix. It's going to be a case where you see heavy curvature like this. Now, just as a side point, you've seen these ellipses before in the second or third lecture of class, right? We saw them when we were talking about Gaussian distributions. And that makes sense because the Gaussian distribution is just e to a quadratic. It's basically just e to the minus x squared. So it turns out as a side point, in a Gaussian, if you take the second derivatives of a Gaussian, the log likelihood of a Gaussian, then the Hessian matrix is just the inverse of the covariance. So that's kind of a side point, but it's just kind of in case you wonder, it gives you some idea of how to visualize it. Okay, so that's another problem with gradient descent. Now, a third problem with gradient descent, which is going to be a problem with everybody, is that I'm only guaranteed to find a local minimum of the objective function. So some error functions are really, really nice, like the squared error. So those are things, it always looks like I have this single bowl, And whenever I find the bottom of that bowl, that's the global minimum. So cell objective functions are nice like that. Other objective functions look like that graph in the slide up there, that there are many, many different local minima, and that's just the way it is. So obviously, gradient descent, there's no way for gradient descent to know whether it's hit a local minimum or a global minimum, because all it knows is the current objective function and the current gradient. So once it hits a gradient of 0, it stops, because there's nothing to descend. And basically, there's basically no good way around this problem. Like, if you can find, so there are certain objective functions that are convex. And convex means that the second derivative is always positive. That's the formal definition of it. And the nice thing about convex functions is that any local in a convex function, any local minimum is also a global minimum. But lots of times you can't use a convex function. So like with neural networks, we'll see, sometimes the objective function isn't convex. And then you just have to settle for finding some kind of local minimum. And that's not just a problem with gradient descent. Even if you use a really nice and clever optimizer, it's not going to give you a guarantee. Usually, it's not going to give you a guarantee of finding a global minimum. You can only hope to find the best local minimum that you can. Okay, so that's what gradient descent is. But for a lot of reasons, gradient descent can be a kind of crappy optimizer. So what are some better ideas? So one way is, say we want to fix this curvature problem that we saw a couple slides ago. Well, one way to do that, so we said, well, why did we pick the gradient in gradient descent? We did that because of Taylor's theorem. We said we're going to approximate this objective function by a line. Well, Taylor's theorem doesn't just talk about first derivatives. It says that a continuous function is essentially an infinite dimensional polynomial. So instead of using Taylor's theorem for first derivatives, I can use the version of Taylor's theorem for second derivatives. And then if I do that, I get something that looks like this. I say I'm going to approximate, so you take the Taylor expansion, you say you pick some point, and you say at this point I want to find a local approximation of this point by a quadratic distribution, so by a bowl rather than by a line. And the way I do that is, so the first two terms are as before when I'm doing a first order Taylor expansion, that the height of this bowl is just going to depend on the objective function at the current point, the point around which I'm taking the expansion. And there's going to be a linear term that depends on the gradient. But now there's going to be a quadratic term. So that's this thing on the right. This is just a way of writing a quadratic function in matrix notation. You know, if I only had one dimension, then this would just look like the quadratic functions. This would just look like a really simple quadratic function. So, and here the quadratic term is given by the Hessian. So in order to compute the second order Taylor expansion, I need to compute both the gradient here in the second term and the Hessian in the third term. And so now I can say, now once I have this an approximation by the quadratic bowl, I'm in a better shape in some ways than when I was just using a line, right? Because when I have a line, I can't go to the minimum of the line. That would take me all the way to infinity. But when I have a quadratic bowl, I can jump all the way to the, I know the bowl has a single minimum. It's convex. So I can jump straight to the unique minimum. And the way you do that, and the way you find the minimum, is the same way that you'd solve any quadratic equation. In one dimension, you could just use the quadratic formula. In multiple dimensions, this is just the generalization of this that says rather than descending in the gradient direction, I'll take the inverse of the Hessian times the gradient. So essentially that twists, if I have a highly curved distribution, that twists the gradient to point towards the local minimum, and I'll take a step of size 1. And actually, the way you derive this is just to take that equation up there, take the gradient of it, set it to 0, and you find the minimum, and you get that. So that's called Newton's method. And so Newton's method says you compute the quadratic approximation, jump to the minimum. If E wasn't actually quadratic, you won't be at the real minimum. So then repeat. Now, so Newton's method is called a second order method because instead of just using first derivatives, I'm also using second derivatives. So Newton's method is really great in the sense that it can converge to the minimum really, really quickly in a small number of iterations, whereas gradient descent can often take a large number of iterations. However, the problem with Newton's method is I have to actually compute that Hessian. So even the size of the Hessian, if I have a really large scale problem, can be an issue. So some of the
So some of the problems that I've worked on in my research are essentially linear regression problems, where instead of having 10 parameters or 100 parameters, you might have 100,000 parameters. So in that case, you can't take the time to compute 100,000 by 100,000 matrix in order to just take one step in weight space. So even though conceptually these second order methods are really very nice, people don't usually use them in practice. So what people do is they use these sophisticated first order methods that only involve gradients, but they kind of warp the gradients in kind of funny ways, sometimes extremely clever ways, in order to try to approximate the effect of actually doing Newton's method. And so those are these things like conjugate gradient, there are quasi-Newton, there are lots of four-letter acronyms. So there are things like quasi-Newton methods like BFGS, like there's another one which is just the name of four guys. There's one called DFP, which is the name of three guys. And then Levenberg-Marquardt, which you could call LN if you wanted to call it something like that, or CG if you want it. And usually some method like this would be, if you want to do a batch optimization method, you'd use some kind of first order method like that. And this lecture's already gotten complicated enough, so I'm not going to talk about what those things are. But you should know that they exist. And if you're calling out to like fminunc or something like that, some kind of library function in MATLAB, it's going to implement one of these first order methods typically. Sometimes a quasi-Newton method. OK, so the final thing that I want to talk about is this idea of constraints. So all the way up until now, I've said assume there aren't any constraints. But sometimes you can't get away from saying having a constrained optimization problem that you have to solve. So here the methods get a lot more complicated. I'm not going to go through them in detail. The methods for constrained optimization as opposed to unconstrained optimization. But I'll give you some picture to kind of give you an intuitive idea of what these things are doing. So this picture, again, in weight space. So the x-axis and the y-axis are two different parameter values. So imagine I have, say, some regression model in which I have only two weights. Now, each of those dashed lines there is, again, a level set of the energy function. So you imagine the energy function is, again, like coming out from the screen. But now, instead of just finding the minimum of the bowl of the energy function, what I want to find is the minimum of the energy function such that the point that I choose lies on that line. Lies on that curve where it says C of x equals 0. So I want to find some value that both lies on the curve and as well as I can minimizes the energy function. So how am I going to do that? So one thing is before. So there are two things you need to think about. One is, of course, the gradient of the energy function, right? Because that's the thing I'm trying to minimize. But also, this constraint thing is a function, and it has a gradient with respect to the weights. And the important thing geometrically is that the gradient of the constraint function is a normal vector. So it points locally in a perpendicular direction to the actual constraint surface. Given that knowledge, imagine I want to wiggle along this curved line in such a way that I minimize the gradient. I could use a really long pointer here.
They don't even let me.
That doesn't point anywhere anyway. So what I want to do is, if the gradient, say the gradient points in some direction that's different, say the gradient of the error points in a different direction than the gradient of the constraint functions. That's what I have up there at the top. So the gradient of the E is pointing in this direction off to the right, and the gradient of C is pointing to this direction up. Then what you can do is you can imagine, you could imagine projecting that gradient onto the constraint surface. So what that means is there's some direction that I could wiggle that I'd still be on the constraint surface, and I'm still making a non-zero, I'm still making some tiny step in the direction of the gradient. I'm kind of stepping off to the side in the direction of the gradient, but I'm still kind of moving in the general direction of the gradient. So the only way that I can't move in the general direction of the gradient is if the gradient is actually pointing perpendicular to the constraint surface. So that means if I weren't on the constraint surface, I'd want to move straight down. Well, that means if I move to the left or if I move to the right, I'm not making the objective function any better. If I want to make the objective function better, I have to go straight down. But I can't, because then I move off the constraint surface. So so geometrically, the whole point of constrained optimization is that when you hit a constrained optimum, the gradient of the function has to point in the same direction as the gradient of the constraint surface. That's this kind of fundamental thing. And the way you write that in equations is just like this.
So imagine C is some kind of vector equation. And so, it just means that that if I take that, that there has to be some set of constant, there has to be some constant that, that shouldn't be a top. Lambda should be some scalar. And there should be some, that the gradient of the, I should be able to multiply the gradient of the constraint by some constant and get the gradient of the energy. And that that constant of proportionality is called the Lagrange multiplier. So you can build this thing which is called the Lagrangian, and then you get something that looks like this, that thing at the top. So what the Lagrangian is, it's a way of saying, well, I don't know how to do constrained optimization, so the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to take the constraints and I'll give you a penalty for violating the constraints. So the thing I want to optimize isn't just my original error function, but it's my original error function plus some penalty that says, well, if the constraint, I want the C of W to be zero. That was the way I defined the problem. So if C of W gets really big, then I'm going to get some penalty with the scale as lambda. And so the nice thing about that is that if I take the derivatives, so this is now a function both, this is some function that I want to optimize. It's a function both of W and of this penalty lambda. And so the nice thing about that is if I take the derivatives, I get the thing that I want. So if I take the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to lambda, then I just get the constraints again. So if I'm at some point where the derivative is zero, then that means the derivative of L with respect to lambda is zero, so I'm within the constraint set. And then if I take the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to W, then I get something that just says the two vectors have to be parallel, which is what I wanted geometrically. So what constraint optimizations do is they make use of this Lagrangian in such a way to try to find some point in which the derivatives are zero. And they get complicated. I'm not going to talk about how that works. All right, so here's the summary. So this is a complex area, but it comes up again and again in machine learning, so it's good to know about. The things that you should really try to take away from this is both how and why we would want to take this learning problem and convert it into an optimization problem, and what the benefits are of doing so. The other thing that's really important to know is that there's this modularity between the modeling that I choose and the optimization algorithm. So I might choose to, I choose to do a linear regression model, right? So in whatever, week two or something like that, we said, oh, you can find the minimum of the likelihood analytically, and you can do that. But you might have reasons for doing some completely different optimization algorithm to try to minimize the exact same error function. So you might have some reason to do an online gradient descent rather than doing the analytic minimization. Or instead of doing gradient descent, you might want to do these really clever conjugate gradient methods. So once you pick a likelihood, there are many, many different algorithms that you could use to optimize that likelihood. And the third thing, that's the important concept. And the third thing is I expect you to understand what gradient descent is and why you want to do it and why it could run into problems, especially this problem of local minima, which is kind of a very important problem in machine learning. Now, the things that I don't expect you to understand is any of this stuff about Newton's method and constrained optimization. You know, I haven't gone through that in enough mathematical detail to expect you to be able to reproduce that. So that's not going to be examinable. But it's good to know that those things exist, to know what are the more complex optimization methods that I would go through. And just to kind of reiterate, in a real problem, if you're using some of these library methods, typically what people end up using for machine learning problems is either they'll use the stochastic online gradient if they have some large amount of data or if you have streaming data, or they'll use one of these fancy first-order methods like quasi-Newton methods or conjugate gradient methods. Okay, so that's all I have to say about optimization. Are there any questions? We have 3 minutes, should be time for two or three. Okay, see you on Thursday.
Hey. About the aphid you mentioned, is it going to dynamically change?
In which one? Here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll change after every iteration.
So if there are some changes in pattern of the function, it will change the speed of...
Yeah. Although, I mean, if you really wanted to do that, you'd want more than one eta, right? You can imagine having, because some directions, say I have a function that looks like this.
Right,
then the eta I want for one direction is different.
It depends on different features, probably your learning.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what kind of what the Hessian does, is it scales different dimensions in different directions.
Yeah, right. And one other thing is what about gradient essence? I mean,
then you'd maximize the function rather than minimizing it.
What would change the mathematics stuff in there?
If you want to maximize?
Yeah,
I mean. Nothing changes. You just add the gradient rather than subtracting it. So it's just a matter of whether
you want changing the steps you take.
Nothing about these things changes if you want to maximize, because maximizing some function f is the same as minimizing minus f. So nothing changes.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Great. Hey. Yeah. They get complicated. That's the only thing. Yeah. There are a lot of good books, but the mathematical level gets high. So one area you can look at is linear programming. So that's the general area of optimizing a linear function with linear constraints. So that's kind of a special case of some of the methods we talked here. So there's a book by Bertsikas, Bertsikas. I think he has one about linear programming and one about nonlinear programming. Bertsikas.